The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What was the source of your redemption after Jane died?
Well, oddly as it happened, Jane asked just days before she died, out of the blue, bringing up a subject we'd not talked about for a very long time, that if something ever happened to her, she wanted her ashes scattered in her five favorite wilderness areas. And that request sent me off into those wilderness areas, and as a means of healing my grief, those wilderness journeys became the stepping stones from one end of it to the other.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with critically acclaimed nature writer Gary Ferguson, author most recently of The Carry Home, Lessons from the American Wilderness. You and Jane were both from the Midwest, so I'd like you to read your description of how your life journey together began.
We'd been restless children, destined to become restless adults, proud members of the last generation to soothe the angst of youth not with Ritalin, but with road trips. What started with the beats of the 40s and 50s, 20-somethings from the Midwest and East Coast, pushing west in Ramblers and Roadmasters, Nomads and Bel Airs, ended with quixotic Pollyannas like us, westering in Volkswagens and Impalas and Ford Econolines. Long before I could even drive, I lay in my bed on spring nights in South Bend, Indiana, listening to the groan of freight trains two blocks away, rumbling west toward Chicago on the Grand Trunk Line, wanting nothing more than to go. At 17, I made it, hopping into those boxcars on Friday and Saturday nights, rolling away past crumbling brick warehouses that circled the edges of the city, out into a land of fields and woodlots and potholed county roads leading to who knows where. Jane, too, started young, making tents out of bedsheets at the edges of her family's cornfields, sweating through the firefly summers, lulled to sleep by the smell of dirt, thrilled, she once told me, by the fact that from the middle of July all the way to harvest, those sprawling cornfields held at least a modest chance to leave the known world, disappear, get lost. 9 months after we met, each of us sold our cars and on a cold December day laid down the money for the slightly used blue Chevy van Martha and I are riding in now, having found it on a car lot in the tiny town of Syracuse, Indiana. With my father's help, through 5 months of sanding and sawing and nailing and wiring, we turned it into a 16-foot rolling home called Moby. In the spring of 1980, we busted a bottle of cheap champagne across the front bumper, then pushed out of the heartland on a journey stretching across 25 years and some 350,000 miles.
Obviously, then, you and Jane were not tourists. You were very experienced in the backcountry. What happened that day when Jane died?
Well, we were very experienced, Cherie, as you say, both on the trail and in a canoe. We had canoed all over North America and in the Arctic. We were big fans of whitewater canoeing. It was our version of dancing, I guess I'd say. We had been at celebrated whitewater canoeing school up in Ontario and were on our way back to Montana. And stopping for what was supposed to be the equivalent of a walk in the park, we put in on a river known as the Kapka River. And we got to a portage place, the place where you take out and carry the canoe around an obstacle. And in this case, the obstacle was about a 300-yard furious run of whitewater, about a Class 5 rapid, which is extremely severe. We got to the portage area, and it had actually been moved because a couple of years earlier there had been a big ice storm, and the trees had blown down to chest-high levels, so it was impossible to actually carry a canoe through there. So they had moved the portage place a little bit closer to the head of the whitewater. That, combined with some historic levels of rain in the previous week, made hydraulics that, long story short, ended up catching us and sweeping us into that furious gale of white water, and it wasn't a matter of if we were going to tip over, it was really when. We probably made it about 150 yards, and then the boat flipped. It had gained a lot of water and become unmanageable. And at that point, I popped up, and the water was so big, 5 or 6 foot waves, that I couldn't see Jane, and just set about trying to push myself off the rocks I was getting slammed against. I was held under twice in recirculation pools and thought that maybe that was going to be my end, but managed to sputter out. And right before the flush pond at the end of the rapid, I got catapulted over about a 5 foot waterfall, and my leg ended up jammed in a crevice in a rock and snapped in two. And then I was carried out by the whitewater into the flush pond. And I waited for her for quite a while. She didn't come. So I splinted my leg and started basically crawling out and swimming out to a road that was about 3 miles to the east, and was able to get help. Search and rescue mounted that evening, and it would take 3 days before finally her body was found in the rapids.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a flush pond, and there were a couple of foreshadowing events that happened right before this accident. One was, as you mentioned, Jane said, "If anything happens to me, would you scatter my ashes?" The other was some loons in that flush pond. Describe what happened with them.
Yes, you know, people have occasionally asked what I think is a very good question, and that's, when did you really know that Jane was gone? And I have to say, it happened in this moment. I was about 100 yards, 150 yards maybe, away from the flush pond. My leg splinted, using a paddle as a crutch, crawling around the and under and over the down timber. And I heard a pair of loons calling back at the flush pond. And loons are sort of delirious anyway in how they call. But this was so over the top and so unusual, so unlike anything I'd ever heard, that for some reason I had the urge to go back, which was quite an ordeal to make it back. But when I got to the edge of the flush pond, there were two loons. And as I was looking at them and considering what they were doing and how they sounded, there was this overwhelming feeling. It didn't come as words. It just came as a bone-deep sensation that I could only describe as a combination of the idea of beautiful and goodbye. And I immediately thought that that was some sort of message, perhaps, but I squelched that thought immediately because I couldn't bear to stand it, and I certainly wasn't going to wait around any longer. I hurried off and got back into this kind of fiercely rational mind so I could make it out and get help. Later, when I got back to Montana, it was interesting. I looked up some of the stories of traditional Ojibwe people who live in that part of Canada, and was just surprised as could be to find that the Ojibwe say that the loons are primarily the messengers between the living and the dead. So I have a very special place in my heart for loons to this day.
There was also another foreshadowing event that involved loons that happened just before you got to the place where the rapids were.
Yes, this was a series of lakes cut by river stretches across the Canadian Shield, which is a granite formation. And in the lake right above the whitewater, just before we got to the whitewater, it had been a rainy, dreary couple of miles, and the sun broke through. Jane and I had actually been talking about our lives together because we were coming up on our 25th anniversary and reviewing our greatest hits, if you will. She had had a very special relationship to loons from being an intern in the Boundary Waters during college, and she absolutely loved that bird as much as any bird. And suddenly, right beside the canoe after the sun broke out, there was a pair. I mean, so close, it was uncanny. Loons are very shy around people, and to see them so close took both of us by surprise. And she was so happy about it. She looked down at the loons and looked up at the sun and laid her paddle on her lap and sort of shouted up to the sky, "Thank you, universe." And those would become very nearly her last words.
You suggest that there are three elements that we need in order to make sense of life. Beauty, which we've talked about a little. Mystery, which seems to me like those loons, their behavior was quite mysterious. And community. Can you explain that belief as it's related to what you describe as the loss of big myth in America?
Yes, I'll start by saying I've been teaching and have been a big fan as a writer of the hero's journey motif for a long time. This is a kind of the primary transition story motif that human beings have used for thousands of years to understand, to model, if you will, how transformation happens when we go through a big event in our lives. Along that hero's journey path, there tends to be in every story you can find about it, helpers that show up. And the way I got familiar with beauty, community, and mystery was by assembling a collection of stories years ago for Crown Publishers in New York for a book called Spirits of the Wild, little tales about how things came to be in the natural world, rainbows and robins with red breasts and just fanciful stories. As I was perusing hundreds and hundreds of those stories, it dawned on me that there were, in fact, according to these storytellers, three things that we needed in order to live well in the world. And the first, as you say, is beauty, an active relationship with beauty. Beauty washing through you, the storytellers said, is what helps you get unstuck when life gives you more than you can handle. It helps you keep anxiety in under control. It helps you find your path. Community was the second quality these storytellers suggested we needed to live well. Community not just with each other, that's certainly important, but with the ground underfoot and the stars and the sun and the entire web of existence. Community as a means of seeing the web of life and finding and feeling deeply your place on that web of life. To belong, to feel like you are a part of things. And then the third is mystery. And I like to say that even Einstein was a big fan of mystery. He said that mystery was the source of all science and all art. He even used to encourage his fellow mathematicians to go out into nature and be overwhelmed by the complexity of the systems that surrounded them. And in that overwhelmed state where their left brain sort of had to surrender to the fact that they couldn't comprehend it, they would be opened up to this creative side of themselves, this mysterious side of themselves, he said. And in that state, they would gain creative capacity and sometimes have breakthroughs in their thinking. So those are the three qualities that not only, I think, have meant a lot to me from a storytelling perspective, but became essential to me in walking this difficult journey from Jane's death and through the years that followed.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with award-winning author Gary Ferguson about his latest book, The Carry Home. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed online. There's audio at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link on our Facebook page. We'll be back shortly to talk about the environmental failures of the boomer generation, and hear another passage from the book. Stay with us. The structure of this book is unusual. It's non-linear, and it all hangs together very beautifully, but it doesn't go from the beginning to the end. Why was that your choice?
Well, you know, I worked almost 6 years on this book, and the structure was what perplexed me. So it took a long time to figure out how to measure out the story in a way that the energy builds, but also to not overwhelm the reader with the intensity of the emotional content. And I thought telling it all in one place would exhaust the reader.
I think it also gave you a chance to write a little bit about your views about the boomer generation, which you feel has dropped the ball a little bit on the environmental issues.
I do, and I have to give a big thanks to Elaine Mason at Norton Publishers in New York, because at first the book was really just about the accident and my recovery, and it was still a good story. But Elaine's notion was that let's plant this in a bigger context. Let's put yours and Jane's life against a backdrop, a social backdrop, and see how those events in your lives are connected to you as people. And so that's when I started talking about the baby boomers. And as you suggest, I'm a little bit hard on them because it's unfortunate that, and this is my generation, that we created arguably the most significant environmental movement in history with an incredible success record with the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the National Environmental Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, Earth Day. The Wilderness Act was passed when we were young in 1964. But somewhere along the way, I think the baby boomers not only got distracted, which happens during a life, but made the mistake of handing off the authority for the well-being of the planet to scientists or to environmental groups and not taking enough personal responsibility for it. I don't say that as a source of us to be guilt-ridden and shame-ridden, but I wonder sometimes now whether or not we need to have the equivalent of a grief journey as a culture, as the baby boom segment of the culture, just to look really honestly at what we did very well and also face where we've dropped the ball and where we made mistakes. Again, not to bring shame on ourselves, but simply to look with critical eyes into what we could have done better. I found that in my own personal grief journey, whenever I was able to stay focused and really look at the difficult circumstances I was in as opposed to distracting myself, that was very tempting. Whenever I was able to face it, there was a grace that showed itself. There was an energy that made itself available to me to take the next step. And I think the same thing might be true for the baby boomers right now.
What do you think would have happened to you after Jane died if you hadn't had this mandate to go to these five places and scatter her ashes?
That's a great question. I mean, I hope that sooner or later I would have stumbled my way through, but besides putting me in touch with beauty, community, and mystery, every time I went out on these journeys to scatter ashes, and on the last two scatterings, I left my front door in Red Lodge and walked 110 miles to Yellowstone to make those scatterings. Without being in the wilderness at that level, one of the things I would have missed out on, I really believe, is the tendency that wilderness has for me and a lot of people to put us in present moment awareness. When I'm in the wild, there's very little consideration of the past and the future, and that's quite an accomplishment in grief because you're very prone early on to just want to be in the past and not want to be in the present or future at all. So to be able to muster present moment awareness in this wash of just tragedy was an amazing gift that the wilderness gave to me. And I fear that had I not had the wild under my feet, I might not have been as able to make it through. The Greek definition for beauty is to be of one's hour. And that can mean two things. It can mean when you're 65, don't act like a 20-year-old, but it can also mean no matter what your circumstances, embrace where you are. And that, again, was a tall order when I was in the throes of grief early on. But to be of one's hour is something I think that's very much fostered and facilitated by wild country.
Mm-hmm. Also, to have to give up control because you realize you don't have any.
That's such a good point because, yes, wilderness always reminds us that we're not in control. We can certainly be prepared to some extent and adjust to circumstances, but we're not in control. We can sit down by the trail and pout all we want about the cold rain and the wind, but that's not going to change it. So we accept it and we deal with it. And that was a very central part of Jane's philosophy for life, and she got that from spending so much time in the wild.
We should point out that none of these places where you went were places you drove up to, got out of the vehicle, and just started scattering ashes. These were all big journeys.
Yeah, they were. And again, that was part of the gift, because in the leaving the car with a pottery vase with her ashes and a silver spoon from my mother's silver collection in my backpack, to walk away from the parking area up the trail and through whatever rush of beauty there happened to be in the canyon lands of southern Utah or in Yellowstone, was a part of the doorway, the portal, the transition time from the front country to the back, to that place where mythologists refer to as sacred time and sacred place. And that's an essential aspect to successful ritual, is sacred time and sacred space. And so that really was an important part of the gift.
Well, it is an absolutely beautifully written book. And it has a happy ending. So let's hear the epilogue.
As I write this, in early February, the creek that rolls past my back door is frozen fast. Little sign of it save the wide path it carved through the belly of the valley long ago in the time of ice. My experience of this time of year has completely changed since Jane's death. Not that I haven't always liked winter, shoosing down untracked slopes on Telemark skis, hooking tow ropes to cars with friends, and pulling each other down old forest roads at dubious speeds. But now I spend a fair amount of time simply taking in the woods. Sometimes during storms, I watch white-tailed deer coalescing into lines, breaking trail through the deep snow. Small familiarities, akin to the little pieces of miracle that so comforted my mother, and at the same time a part of the grand stories Kenneth Rexroth talked about, pieces of the myths that make us human. The tragedy has left me feeling more aligned with that Inuit notion Jane and I ran across in the Arctic, the one that claims the whole world can be comprehended by paying attention to the relationships at your feet. I also find myself trying to figure things out, childlike things of little consequence, like just how long a bald eagle is willing to sit on the cottonwood branch outside the house and scan the creek for fish before he gives up the effort and tries someplace else. It's in the woods just beyond my door where I'm likely to recall that life as we know it wouldn't even arise in the first place unless it also passed away. Each morning now, all through the winter, there arrives to the edge of the creek a plain little bird, the dipper, jumping off blocks of ice in even the worst weather to pluck larvae from the bottom of the stream, then back up onto the ice again, where she bobs up and down for a time, looking like a little kid about to wet her pants because she's got something important to say. Jane and I used to pretend the dipper we saw across our 14 years together in this house was the same bird. We called her Darlene. For reasons I don't fully understand, winter, if not my favorite season, is in these days the one I'm most drawn to. On every night of cloudless sky, Orion and Gemini and Libra come rolling overhead, through heavens so clear I can see starlight shimmering in the forest, a time well after the end of things and long before they begin again. When every morning I stand in the living room, arms down, and my face inches away from the east-facing window, breathing in and breathing out, considering one more time the right kind of devotion needed to conjure from that snow and ice the buds of spring. As so often happens when someone dies, especially someone relatively young and strong and full of fire, in the years following the accident, there came to those of us who loved Jane a somewhat tilted vision. It was a kind of delightful penchant for elevating her courage, her astonishing enthusiasm, to dimensions more rightly suited to the gods. We spent countless seasons being both hugely thrilled and deeply saddened by our bedazzling memories of her laughter, her kindness. But Jane didn't live in some kind of paradise of ease and contentment. Like any of us, she was never completely free of doubt or fear or uncertainty. It's been good for me to see this, to reach a point where I can know her again as fully human. Among the greatest gifts she gave, after all, had nothing to do with perfection. Rather, it was the sweet reassurance, the simple boost of spirit that comes from having known someone who managed to see the mythical shining through the mundane. There's good news these days, mixed in with all the craziness, as we push together into this new millennium. But then I suppose that's the way it's always been. America's 20-somethings, the goat herders, the young woman shuttling local organic produce, Even a group of young African Americans in the Yerba Buena section of San Francisco grinding for the green. Keep reminding me that we still have choices. Close to home, hundreds of people are making heroic efforts to establish critical wildlife migration corridors, including a passageway from Yellowstone through the Canadian Rockies all the way to the Yukon. Meanwhile, the old McLaren mine near Cook City, which has been leaking deadly poison into a major watershed at the edge of Yellowstone for more than 120 years, is now nearly reclaimed. Windmills are going up on the High Line. Little kids are running around Yellowstone, deliriously happy. And in my hometown of Red Lodge, a nature camp has been started in Jane's honor. Now every summer, kids get the chance to traipse through meadows of phlox and forget-me-nots, kneel on the banks of mountain streams, shoulder their packs, and set off on the same trails she roamed all those years. And there's something else, too, something truly amazing. Terry Tempest Williams once said about grief that it, quote, dares us to love once more. In the spring of 2013, I took that dare. I met a remarkable woman from Portland named Mary Claire, a social psychology professor, a listener, a champion of diversity and justice, and beyond that, a survivor of her own runs of heartbreak and calamity. We would fall in love in these uplands of the Northern Rockies and also wandering that great northwestern city of hers amidst the azaleas and roses under the London plane trees of Laurelhurst Park. From the very beginning, we walked everywhere. And 6 months after we met, on a brilliant day in August, we walked to Becker Lake, that place in the Beartooth where Jane's ashes had been scattered 4 years earlier. Standing on a ridge high above the eastern shore of the lake, Mary's hand in mine, I opened my mouth and called out into a warm southern breeze. "Jane," I said, "this is Mary." And far below, for a minute or so afterward, there was this dazzling little miracle of wind and water and light running up the south end of the lake. We married the following winter on Rock Creek, on a morning in January when the dipper was flitting from ice floe to ice floe and the sun seemed like a village bonfire hanging in the air, lighting 14 inches of fresh snow. Our lives, too, like every life, are unfolding as wilderness. On any given day, there's both beauty and chaos standing together, just as the Paiute said they would. In some ways, the miles we're traveling together now have been sweetened by our wounds, by each of us having learned beyond the shadow of a doubt that nothing lasts forever. It isn't really fear that arises from such notions, such feelings of impermanence, at least not on our good days, but rather a simple appeal for presence, an invitation to life. And when we accept, there often comes a feeling of being on the finest, brightest of paths, free of future, unshackled by past, all of life encompassed in a single step, and then another, strung together like pearls in our long, precious journey from beautiful to goodbye.
Gary Ferguson lives in Red Lodge, Montana, and Portland, Oregon. You can listen to this program again and find more information about him and his 22 books at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Links to that information are also on our Facebook page. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.